Thank you. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Gwintelligent Podcast. I am David Marver of Change the Padres, joined by Padres Jagoff.
Marver, it's good to have you back on the podcast, and it's nice that we have another special guest on the podcast this week.
Yes, we are joined by Dan Zimborski, creator of the Zips Projection System. Dan, this is your second time on the podcast. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me. It's always fun. Hopefully, I'm not in too much trouble for things I've said.
Well, I was excited to talk about that because you were recently attacked mercilessly by a segment of the Padres fan base.
You met every Joe Dickhead in Irvine, by the way, or not Irvine,
Lakeside, Alpine. Lakeside, Alpine, yeah.
Lakeside, Alpine, yeah.
If I can't get someone mad in this job, then I'm in the wrong profession.
Well, can I ask this? Are Padres fans, and you dealt with this before because you were one of the few people who openly hated the Matt Kemp trade when it was made, which, of course, as we've all learned now, was just as bad as you'd projected back then. Is the Padres fan base uniquely terrible at white knighting and then attacking, let's say, you, for instance?
No, honestly, pretty much every fan base has that segment that, you know, I don't want to be too over the top, but, you know, that tend to be very homerism, tend to, you know, always think with you know, rose-colored glasses or whatever uniform-colored glasses are related to the team, which is blue for some reason with the Padres right now instead of brown, but that's a rant for another day.
Sadly, yeah.
No, you can win back most of those fans by just always staying, bring back the brown.
Well, no, you should be thinking of spicy mustard when you see the Padres, and so that has always kind of disappointed me that they still won't go back to that. But no, I mean, fans get mad at me. I won't lie and say that I don't egg it on a little bit because I have a weird personal enjoyment for abuse, but it's pretty amusing. I don't think I even said anything too like over the top. I didn't say Padres suck, you'll never win. I just said maybe they shouldn't sign Eric Hosmer like he's a star. But you know how people. I'm sure you get the same thing from people at times.
Oh, absolutely. But let's talk about Hosmer actually, because you've been very vocal about stating that he's probably going to be the most overpaid or one of the most overpaid free agents in baseball, in the sense that his likely production over the contract he's going to get or what we've heard is rumored that the Padres have offered, he likely will not produce over that series of time for the money that he's going to get paid. So in that sense, he would be a bad signing, right? Because the amount that you're getting for what you're paying him is not equitable.
Yeah, when I was talking about him being a poor signing for the Padres, given the situation that they're in, there are a lot of teams where I think can make a justification to sign Hosmer. But at that point, we were talking like about maybe a 4 or 5 year contract. Now that we're hearing the Padres offered a 7 year contract, which is disturbing on so many levels, I tend to like it even less now because the fact that he hasn't jumped at it and said, oh, quick, sign it. Makes me wonder just how high this is going to go from the Padres, but we'll see. Maybe it was like, because they said largest team history, it could have been 7 years, $84 million or something. I mean, I doubt that, but that would have been pretty funny actually.
Yeah. So before I play devil's advocate on the Hosmer signing, and just to be clear, I think both Jagoff and I agree that it is an inefficient use of money, certainly. And we'll talk about that in a little bit, but I have a general question for you. At what point should we be pragmatic about who we sign? And when I say that, I mean, Padres Jagoff and I were both very vocally on board with the tank. And I think we would both agree that the best approach for the team long term would be to tank another season and to just continue to accumulate top draft picks. They're not going to do that. Ownership has said multiple times they're not going to do that. They've even publicly disdained the Astros approach and the Cubs approach and said they're not doing that. So given that we know they're not doing that, and ownership statements that they want to get back up to 500, and they kind of want to slowly build, they refuse to use the term rebuild. Is Hosmer a slightly better signing under that? Like, knowing that the ownership is going to try to get to 500, and there are many bad ways that they could do it, trading for Matt Kemp, for example, all those different things that they would possibly think are things that are improving the club. Would Hosmer be better in that scenario since he's 28? Does that help him at all?
in that very specific scenario, it makes it less bad. But at this point, we're kind of talking about, hey, Dan, I want to put my hand in the oven. What temperature should I put it at, 400 or 450? 400 would be a little better. My hand wouldn't get as burnt. The thing about Hosmer is it's just such a poor use of resources. I mean, you tell me. I mean, you really think nobody thinks the Padres are going to have, say, $180 million payroll in 3 years?
No.
Even if we're very generous, let's say we're super generous and they max out at like 150. I think it's probably on the high side of where they'll go, but let's say 150. You're already, before the team is even in contention, before the team even knows what its needs will be when they hit contention, to already devote 15% of the budget for a player who's never had two really good seasons in a row, it's just mind-boggling. It's one of those contracts you look at when they're signing and say, there's no way this is going to work out. In a million years, there's no way this work out. Because even when it works out, it's not that good. I mean, if Hosmer's a 2.5-win player, dependably, it still doesn't work. So it's just frustrating. I mean, I'm not even a Padres fan, and I'm frustrated about it. So I can't imagine how some people who are more inclined to say, hey, why can't this team be the Cubs or the Astros or the Indians or maybe the White Sox in a couple years? I'd just be incredibly frustrated.
Yeah, I just look at it, and I guess Jagoff and I have somewhat similar viewpoints in terms of we want them to kind of avoid the worst-case scenario where they do something that significantly hurts their actual window, which might open up in 3 years or so. And so Jagoff's been rooting for some very short-term, higher-dollar moves because that way it's off the books. It doesn't really affect us going forward. We don't even lose the draft pick compensation if you do something like that. But you brought up an interesting thing, which is that Hosmer has not had two good seasons in a row. He's been in the league for 6 years. He's had three what I would classify as good to, you know, not quite great, but good seasons, and three that were practically useless. Do you think that's actually an expression of like an actual attribute that he has, that he's simply a hot and cold hitter seasonally? Or do you think it's some randomness? I mean, if he's a 2.5-win player, right? And let's just, he's average, I think, something like 2.7. But let's say he's a 2.5-win player. In any given year, he could outperform or underperform. And so there's a chance that he's actually a 2.5-win player that consistently, that just happened to draw the three bad seasons and the three good seasons in the six marbles that he drew out of the bag, right? Do you think it's an actual attribute, though, that he's going to continue to have good seasons intermixed with bad seasons, or is it just some sort of randomness?
I do think there's a good deal of randomness involved. When I talk about how he's never had two good seasons in a row, I think part of it is, even if it's 2.5 wins a year on average, when you're signing a player to a 7-year deal, you also kind of hope for a little more consistency. And, you know, it's one thing when a star that goes, like, say, between 6 wins and 4 wins a year is inconsistent, like the Brett Saberhagen kind of pattern. That would have been one thing. But even if you just take him at his average, it's just not that exciting to have a 2.5-win-a-year player. There's probably some streakiness involved because he's had, like, half seasons within the good seasons that were poor and poor half seasons in the good seasons. And I don't think it's as much predictive as it looks. But that probably doesn't help him because I know a lot of people say, well, maybe it's not predictive and you just have all good seasons. Like, yeah, you can bet on that, sure.
If you were looking to sign a player, and I'm sorry, I think Jagoff's actually having some problems with his mic, so I'm just going to keep talking. I know I get a lot of flack on the podcast for talking over Jagoff, but this time I have an actual excuse. So Hosmer's produced basically 14 WAR by Fangraphs over his first 6 seasons. If you were looking to sign him, would you prefer to have him have consistently produced the same 14 divided by 6 every single season? Or do you prefer the scenario where he's actually shown the ability to be a 4+ win player in some individual seasons? Or does that not matter to you?
I think generally speaking, when you're in contention, you're a little more resistant to taking risks. And I think when you're actually signing him for the purpose of contending, you probably do want to have a little more, less leeway on either side of how good or bad he'll be. So I think you'd prefer him to be more consistent. I don't know that he won't be. He very easily could. I'm just not a fan of him as a player overall. And I think if they wanted to win now, I think they should have focused on getting players who are likely to be or have a chance to be special players or fill a drastic need when the team is good, because they're already moving a player out of position just to bring in Hosmer. It's not a pressing need. Will Myers is fine at first. He's never had a full healthy season in the outfield. And it's too early to say, well, Josh Naylor is done. I think I come around to the same point. I just don't get it at all. I think that it's short-sighted. It's just bad.
Dan, would you, so I think a lot of our thoughts are tanking is obviously optimal for us. But at the point that we realize ownership's not going to, I'm open to other options. And, you know, ownership has said, you know, we're not looking at Hosmer for 2018. We're looking in the future. And I guess if you take them on face at that, like hypothetically looking at people that are on the market this year, like let's say ownership is dead set on signing someone, like, does someone like Darvish make sense for a team like the Padres, like more than someone like Hosmer? Like, is there anyone on the market that pops out at you that even makes some sense that you could rationalize it in your head that this could help the team later on?
Well, Darvish would have made a lot more sense, because Darvish has the potential to be a Cy Young candidate, a guy who will still be good in the rotation in 3 years when the team is good. He's the kind of player that's hard to develop yourself. I mean, Hosmer, I don't want to over-exaggerate and say he doesn't have any value, but you can develop an Eric Hosmer a lot easier than you can develop a Yu Darvish. So if you are going to spend money, go after something that you don't have and that's hard to make. And it's hard to make a Yu Darvish compared to an Eric Hosmer. And it's even harder to make a Jake Arrieta compared to an Eric Hosmer. And I think that would have been a lot more interesting, especially because there's still more questions about the Padres pitching staff long term than some of the position players, because they have a lot of interesting things. I think one of the problems is that the word tanking is just too much of a loaded word in a way. I think what's key is don't look at it as tanking per se, but look at it as rebuilding in a sense where you can, because the things a bad team has is they have the benefit of being able to do things that contending teams can't do. They can take chances. They can take those upside plays because people act like contending is, or rebuilding is, just about accumulating top prospects and they all get good at the same time, which isn't really the case. You're going to have some of those players develop, but you also have to look at those low risk, high upside guys and give them a chance to prove you wrong. I hate to get back to the Astros again, but they're such a good example. Carlos Correa was a top prospect, but Dallas Keuchel and Jose Altuve were not. And when they were a poor team, they had the luxury of seeing what they had in those players that a poor team, or that a contending team, wouldn't just have that luxury to just say, let's see what we have in Dallas Keuchel. Let's give him some time to develop. And that's really the bigger thing about rebuilding than the draft picks. It's just doing these things and accumulating, just answering questions about players you have in the system. And I think the Padres, position player-wise, they have a lot of guys that have questions like that you want to know more about and you want to see them try.
One of those guys is Jose Rondon, who Jagoff and I, prior to the Freddy Galvis trade, I think we both stated that we were fine just letting him play a season just to see what he has, because then you can sort of move on. I think he's one of the players that sort of fits the mold in what you're talking about, right? And I think Jose Perello would be another example. And signing Hosmer means you're moving Myers to left and not getting a look at Jose Perello. Not that I think he's likely to be a long-term player, but you never know. You might be able to trade him and get something for him.
You could also say Franchi Cordero. I mean, he's someone who you know, we'd like to see, I think, and kind of see what we have there.
Or Jankowski. Any of those guys, really.
Or Cordoba. There's a lot of guys that the Padres, because they do have some pretty top prospects coming in behind them in the middle infield. So this is a good time to try to learn about some of these guys. I don't think Rondon's going to be a star, but I think you want to find out more about him. Because I think if they hit on him, it benefits the organization so much more than if they get the upside from Freddy Galvis. The upside of hitting on that Rondon is so much higher for the team.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the best case scenario for Galvis is that he has like an astronomical season and either is somehow valuable to trade deadline, which I really don't see happening, or he makes himself a valuable player in free agency and he might decline a qualifying offer. I mean, I think that's like the only path for value out of Galvis at this point. Padres fans are pointing towards maybe with an improved infield defense, it'll somehow help the pitching prospect trade values. But I don't see that happening.
Yeah, there's only so much you can do with defense. I mean, even if we assume he's like a plus 10 run a year defender, that's like every pitcher gets an extra less run a year. It's not something that can really make that big a difference. It's not like he turns prospects that would have a 5 ERA into like 3.5. So I think that kind of thing's overrated.
Yeah.
And you see a lot of the terrific pitchers today develop with some pretty poor shortstops. Like that young Braves rotation in the early 90s. I mean, they had Jeff Blauser at shortstop. The Cubs, they turned some guys around with Starlin Castro at shortstop at the time. So I think that's really overrated. And I think it's more looking for an excuse to justify the Galvis signing than actually a reason you go into it.
Yeah. So back to Hosmer for a second. I want to, again, play devil's advocate just for a minute. So he's 28. Guys who are 28 that are, you know, good or at least average-ish don't hit free agency very often. There's normally like one or two guys a year. I'm actually going to name all the guys that have signed since 2000 that the signing team got a year. One of their the first season after they signed was an under age 30 season. I know that's a backwards way of saying it, but so you have your superstar guys that hit it, you know, 25, like Alex Rodriguez and Adrian Beltre. But then you have a group of guys that the Padres have an opportunity to sign, or someone that belongs to that group of players. Those players are, I'm just going to skip ahead to 2005 because these are the more recent ones. Rafael Furcal, Aramis Ramirez, Mark Teixeira, Adam Dunn, Carl Crawford, Prince Fielder, Jose Reyes, Melvin Upton, Pablo Sandoval, Jason Hayward, Justin Upton. That's the entire list of free agents over the past 12 years that the signing team got an under 30 season from. And I'm not including guys that are, you know, one-off relief pitchers or starting pitchers that might have signed like a 1 or 2 year deal afterwards. These are your major signings. And the thing I want to highlight is the teams they signed for. Dodgers, Cubs, Yankees, Nationals, Red Sox, Tigers, Braves, Red Sox, Cubs, Tigers. And there's one Marlins in there, Jose Reyes. I feel like the Padres never really have an opportunity to sign a player like this. And there's an opportunity, or at least I can see a scenario in which Hosmer's zero win seasons were flukish. They were just a random poor draw out of that hat of six seasons. And he's actually a better player than the 2.5 wins above replacement that he's been over his contract. And I think there's something to belonging to this group of players, because you don't hit free agency at 28 unless you were a highly thought about prospect that had the opportunity to move quickly through a system that actually performed in the minor leagues and then got to the major leagues and didn't really get sent down early. So their arbitration clock was continuing to run and they were actually pretty decent. I mean, I think there is something to belonging to this family of players. Now, I know a lot of these guys have become busts. Pablo Sandoval, obviously. Jason Hayward's a very debatable one. I still kind of like him as a player, but I would say that his contract doesn't look particularly great at this point. Prince Fielder, obviously, there were some health issues there. Carl Crawford. But a lot of those other names are actually pretty good players who at the time had some questions about them. Aramis Ramirez, if you remember, he had a similar thing where he had a season not too close to free agency where he was less than one win above replacement player. So I think I look at it a little bit differently as an opportunity to sign a player that belongs to a group of players that historically has been pretty strong that the Padres never have an opportunity to sign. I mean, they were never in the ballpark of signing any of those other guys except Pablo Sandoval, which, of course, is the worst one, so that's not a great point. But I want to get your take on, you know, the opportunity to sign a youngish player out of free agency, because the opportunity is fairly rare.
Oh, it is fairly rare, but you also look at that list of teams, and it's also teams that could afford to make a mistake and overpay for that certainty. And I don't really think that the same certainty exists with Hosmer as it does from some of the other players on that list either. I just think that like generally speaking, it tends to be a poor use of resources, and I'm not sure I could be convinced otherwise. I mean, you could develop a player like Eric Hosmer. I mean, it's not simple, but you can do that. And I don't think he's one of those types of players. I think he's more comparable to Sandoval than some of the other free agents on that list, simply because of his desirability. Obviously, he's in better shape than Pablo Sandoval. Yeah. So that's something he has going for it. But I just can't see it really being a net benefit, simply because of the payroll situation the Padres in and what their needs are. Because say when Sandoval was signed, he also filled a pressing need that was also present at that time, to, you know, fill third base for a couple years. It didn't work, and the Red Sox, you know, they managed in the end to get around that. But I just don't see the benefit for the Padres here, even if Hosmer, say, a 3-win-a-year player. I just don't think that there's enough of a specific benefit to the team to have him there.
Dan, I've got one more Eric Hosmer question. You know, our ownership and management or whatever says they're highlighting things like leadership qualities and changes in culture, which are hard to quantify, and I don't personally buy. But a lot of comparisons get made to a player like Jason Worth when he was signed by the Nationals. I lived in D.C. at the time. I followed the Nationals pretty closely at the time. And I've argued that the signing of Jason Worth didn't really change the culture. It was actually like bringing in Strasburg more than anything, but also Harper. Like, do you see there being – did you see any effect on a team like the Nationals when they did sign Jason Worth where, you know, here in San Diego – I think the narrative is, you know, you sign a guy like Hosmer and you really show that you really create like a winning culture of some kind. Did you see any effect like that with the Jason Worth case or with any other similar cases like that?
Personally, I'm sorry.
Is there any value really in that?
Well, the thing about intangible value is that, even though you can't put a number on it, you also can't put whether it's positive or negative. There's this kind of it's weird because when you talk about like clubhouse guys, there's almost this oversimplistic storyline around it. They say, okay, X player is good clubhouse man. Move him to here. He will be good clubhouse man here. But, you know, situations are different. People are different. People get along with each other in different ways. And I think that does kind of tend to be overblown. And I think the Nationals know it. If you told them in advance that Jason Worth would have two-win seasons in 7 years, but he was popular in the clubhouse and the fans liked him, if they'd still do that contract, they'd say, not in a million years. They signed him because he thought he'd be a better player than he turned out to be for the 7 seasons. I mean, these things have value, but they tend to be kind of in the margins, kind of like the surprise value. Like, just because Eric Hosmer did well in a clubhouse with a bunch of players he played with for a long time, that doesn't mean you just sign him, move him across the country, well, half across the country, and then he'll be able to do well with another group of players. I think a lot of it is very overblown. Personally, the players are going to like, you know, their friends that are on the team. That doesn't necessarily mean they became a better team because of it. You have kind of a unique conflict of interest when you're a player on a team and talking about your friends on the team. And Hosmer is a popular guy with his friends on the Royals. I think it's an overrated thing. You sometimes get some nice surprises and some nasty surprises, but I think in the end you have to put the best roster together and then just hope it works out unless there's like a specific reason.
Well, I will say fans turned on Worth pretty quickly in D.C. You know, when you throw up bad seasons and you're one of the highest paid players, fans have a tendency to turn on them pretty fast. So, I mean, it's definitely not a sticky attribute, I think. It may be popular at signing, but not, you know, not as time goes by.
Yeah, I agree. But, I mean, we'll see. As I said, I don't know how many ways I can say it differently that I just don't think the Padres have a good long-term plan. And that's probably driven more by ownership than anything in reality. So there's only so much you can really fault Preller. But, you know, when your name's on the handiwork, you're part of it.
Yeah, I think we've been very vocal in having great disdain for how frequently the Padres change plans. Like, one of the things we've said is that if every year you're changing plans, in effect, you don't have a plan, right? So it would be nice to see them just have an overarching plan and stick to it. I do think there's something to building the farm. I don't quite understand why they're so quick to want to add talent to the major league roster when they're clearly not a competitor. But I don't know. Real quick, on Hosmer, what are the odds you think that he actually exceeds his contract, or that he, you know, outplays his contract? And let's assume, because obviously you're going to have a number in order for it to make some sense, let's assume the six-year, $120 million offer, which has been thrown out there multiple times, let's say he accepts that, right, and he comes to San Diego. How many wins above replacement over those 6 years does he have to produce in order to justify that contract? And what are the odds of that actually happening?
Well, I can actually, if we can filibuster for a minute, I can actually open up Zips here and see what Zips says for the exact 6 years, and we'll assume San Diego for the purpose. I can give you actually, you know, the projected chance of him doing that.
Absolutely. I'll filibuster for a minute here while you do
or
that.
Or talk really, really slowly.
Yeah.
Like no, the Chipmunks record slowed down.
So let's say that you were in position, you know, Preller's position, and you know, you lose out on Hosmer. Either you have a second to, you know, you have regrets about possibly signing him, so you don't sign him, or someone else swoops in, maybe the Cardinals, and signs him. Next offseason, is there a player? I know there's a lot of major players on the market: Bryce Harper, Machado, Donaldson, etc. Is there a player in next year's crop to you that stands out as a possible fit for the Padres long term? As an alternative that we could root for?
So I assume for this purpose, I'm not allowed to say, you know who fits well? Bryce Harper. I assume I'm not allowed to do that.
Well, I mean, we are very vocal that we think that even though he might get a $500 million contract, that it could actually make some sense for the Padres, but we're also pragmatic about it. We know that's not going to happen, so we're not hanging our hats on that, you know?
Yeah. I'm just trying to think. Probably the best thing to do would be see where the pitching staff is, and if we're not talking about top guys, is to just kind of see what they need to actually fill the roster then. That's the problem with playing this roster kind of prediction a year ahead of time, is because you always know that Bryce Harper is probably going to be awesome, and that Manny Machado is going to be awesome, and you know Dallas Keuchel is going to be really good. But when you're talking about the secondary players, that's almost more, you know, team need based. And without knowing exactly what the team's specific needs will be in a year, because you could have a pretty big change just based on who gets injured, who has a breakout season, what trades you make over the season. There's quite a bit of variability. And the thing about the free agent year next year is it is very top heavy. You have those names at the top. You might even have, you know, Clayton Kershaw, which is probably not going to happen. But there's still that kind of weakness of secondary talent that you're really seeing this year too, and last year, which is part of the reason that free agencies have been so slow. So it's probably hard to really put exact names on, except for the great guys. You'd say, yeah, sure, they'll take them.
Yeah. No, I think the thing that scares me, and I think the only reason I feel like Hosmer is available for us, is that there are teams that are gunning for next year's free agency, right? And the way the new luxury tax works, teams are trying to get under it this year so that next year, I think the penalty is less, right? So you have teams like the Dodgers that are actively giving up payroll this year in order to give themselves more wiggle room in the future. And I feel like that's going to price the Padres out next year on most of the palatable guys. But I think the point you make is good, right? If Fernando Tatis Jr. has a bad year or suddenly can't play shortstop in the future, Elvis Andrus becomes like a reasonable name to target next offseason, for example, even though he'll be in his 30s and playing shortstop. But
oh, well, anyway, I do have Hosmer up. Zips gives him a 23% chance of being worth 120 over 6 years. Okay. That comes up to an average of about 2.4 WAR a year. But you have to take into consideration the uncertainty of the future, that a player who you think is a 2.4 WAR player now is almost certainly less in the future. So when we say 2.4 WAR, it's actually a fairly big ask. And you can see why most players that you think are 2.4 WAR, 2.5 WAR at the time, end up being less in the end, simply because, I mean, you have to subtract a certain amount a year. Because Hosmer's not a developing player.
Yeah. Is there a scenario where Hosmer ends up being worth something close to $200 million? Like he produces, I'm asking somewhat of an abstract question, but let's say that he's actually a 4-win above replacement player and he's had some unlucky bad seasons based on random draw. And I know the odds of that happening are low, but if his base point to start from is four wins above replacement, how much does that shift? And the reason I'm getting to this is that, you know, in basic game theory, if you are the worst team, you try to have a high variance strategy. So you try to do the things that give you the highest chance of getting a huge advantage. And so if there's even a 5-10% chance of Hosmer becoming a $200 million player and you have him signed for $120 million, it's a very high variance strategy that might work out for a team like the Padres that doesn't have a great opportunity to otherwise produce large $80 million surplus values in individual players. So I'm curious, I don't have my own projection system, but I'm just wondering exactly how much of a pipe dream is that? Is that a 5% pipe dream? Is it a 1% pipe dream?
Oh, well, Zip says about 2.5% while I have it open. Because essentially, for a very simple rule of thumb, when you don't have like a projection system, because most people don't have it on demand like I tend to have on demand, one of the rules of thumb is to subtract half a win a season. To be $200 million at today's prices with 5% growth, you need to be about a four-win-a-year player. You need about 24 wins over those 6 years. But, I mean, that's four win a year. But when you consider that you lose half a win a year, roughly, then you'd have to believe that Eric Hosmer's true level of ability, his over-under for 2018, is 5.25 wins above replacement. And that's a pretty aggressive thing, because I mean, then it goes, you know, 5.5, 4, 5.25, 4.75, 4.25, and that gets it to 24. But you essentially have to believe he's a little better than a 5-win player to really have a chance to break even on $200 million. I'm not going to sign him for $200 million. That would be pure profit. I really hope he doesn't sign for $200 million, or everything I've learned about reality is wrong.
Dan, I have a quick question on the value of WAR. It's something I've wondered about. Is the value of WAR a straight line value, or in things like the free agent market? Let's say a player like Clayton Richard on the Padres, who produced about 2 WAR last year, and then signed a contract with the Padres for significantly less than that for the next 2 years. Let's say a 1 WAR player, is that first WAR valued less on the market? Like from what I've kind of look at a player that's a 4 WAR player, you're really paying for him his like third and fourth WAR in that year, because there's a much greater supply of players that can supply you 1-2 WAR at lower prices. So like is there a curve of the value, or do you see it as a straight line value?
That's one of those funny things, is that intellectually, when you think about it, there absolutely should be a curve, because that's how a utility works. You want to spend more for a 5-win player than 5-1-win player, because you have a 25-man roster and you have a set number of rotation spots and lineup spots. You can't just say, oh, well, we could sign 5 5-win players, or we could sign 25 1-win players. It wouldn't work at all. You'd be out of time to make a good team, because your 25 1-win player team is a 72-win team. But the weird thing is that in reality, it has tended to be pretty linear, especially when you match it up against the projections. Like if I talk about Clayton Richard. I mean, Zips doesn't think of him as a 2-win player. I doubt the market does. I mean, I do a lot of work of this type, and I don't think that he was really valued that highly. But there's an interesting thing and an interesting but there. The last few off seasons, possibly as teams have gotten more and more advanced with some of the analytics they're doing with contracts and the like, I think we're starting to see it become more non-linear, because some of these 1- and 2-win players are attracting no interest whatsoever in the market. And all the attention is on like a few stars, which is why we've seen the huge trades rather than teams trying to accumulate some of that middle class from free agency. So it hasn't been linear yet, but I think we might be getting to the point where it is becoming non-linear.
The other thing I've noticed in free agency this year is relief pitchers getting paid. And we noticed, last couple off seasons, there's been some, and trade deadlines, there's been some pretty high profile relief pitcher trades. what does that mean for Brad Hand and the Padres? He's kind of an interesting case because he was a failed starting pitcher, moved to relief pitcher, and really since he's become Padre, he seems to be getting better and better every single time he's out there. I know that's obviously an overstatement, but his numbers continue to improve. At what point do you think the Padres should pull the plug and cash out on that? Is that something that should have happened last trade deadline? Do you see Brad Hand still being good this year? What would you do?
I think he'll still be good, but there's always a certain amount of risk with a pitcher. That when you have a pitcher at the top of their game and is pitching well, there is a time where you're going to want to trade him. You don't want to wait too long because pitchers are very fragile. I can point back to Tyson Ross. The Padres waited and waited to trade him at the top of his value, and then like that, it was gone. And that can happen very quickly. And I think there's a certain point where you say, you know, we need to get it. As long as the packages are being involved, their quality, there's a point where you're just being a little too greedy. I mean, greed is good, but there has to be a limit. And I think you look at the A's and Sonny Gray, they could have gotten even more a couple years ago before he had injury problems. And this kind of thing has backfired on teams frequently. And I think the Padres are in a position where they need to try to extort as much as they can from him. Because one thing that is available in free agency has been top relief pitchers. Where it's generally been thin elsewhere, there have been some excellent closers, excellent middle relievers available. So they've attracted a lot of interest because you go after what you can get. I think that they probably should be a little more urgent at trading Hand.
Well, what's he worth? What would we? I mean, if the Padres traded Brad Hand and we got a mysterious package back, what should we be rooting for in that package? Like, what's a fair trade value for him at this point in terms of top 100 prospects?
You, depending on how desperate the team is, I think you could get a top 50 prospect at a couple throw-ins. Or you could get maybe a couple guys on the fringe of top 100. I don't think you're going to get a huge package. You're not going to match what the Yankees got for Chapman. But I do think that you can get a valuable player for the future.
I guess for me, I see the Padres holding on to Brad Hand as signaling of what they're thinking for 2018.
I do too, because I have no faith in them.
Well, yeah, obviously I got very little faith also. In my head, my brain is telling me that Ron Fowler is going to make them hold him until next season looks like a for sure lost cause, which will probably be at the trade deadline. And the narrative among the fans that have berated you on Twitter will be, oh, you can always get a better deal at the trade deadline for a reliever. But to me, I mean, I think the fact, let's say they get through the offseason and don't trade him, like that's a major signal to me that they really are pursuing this just terrible plan to shoot for 500 next year.
Yeah, I'm thinking that if they really do fully commit to that, we're gonna see another turnaround in about a year, like we did after the Matt Kemp offseason. So it's the Padres are kind of the opposite of the Rockies in this, is that the Rockies never really have a plan, while the Padres just cycle through plans that they never finish.
Ugh, and yet the Rockies are finding more success than the Padres.
Yeah, because
and the Rockies have quite a few young players that they've brought along patiently, brought them up to the major leagues, fairly patiently, giving them some time, and in some respects they've been doing a rebuild, better than the Padres have. They've accumulated quite a bit of pitching talent over there.
Yeah, because one thing about the Rockies is that they don't do their individual moves in a vacuum don't tend to be bad. But they never really go together that well. The Padres like to make plans and make moves that go towards that end, but the moves aren't very good. It's like the Padres follow good plans poorly, and the Rockies do the opposite.
Which one would you rather be?
I don't know. I think possibly the Rockies, because I think selling an organization on a plan rather than being patient is probably a little bit easier. Plus Nolan Arenado.
Yeah. So one other player the Padres fans have been clamoring for this offseason is Christian Yelich. Miami is obviously, they've been shopping everyone. They've already traded Stanton. They've made other trades. Yelich and their catcher are both on the trading block. Yelich is interesting in that his contract is a huge surplus, right? With Stanton, it wasn't quite certain whether or not he was going to live up to that contract. It's certainly a much larger burden to take on than a 25-year-old Yelich. I've seen, you know, it's going to remind you of all those old baseball forum trades where one person who's a homer is proposing to trade all of our trash for your one great player. I kind of want to put that to rest. What would it take off the Padres roster to get Christian Yelich realistically? And you can include plausible scenarios where they're taking back Wei-Yin Chen's contract or some other contract. What would be an actual realistic package you think the Padres could put together for Yelich?
You'd probably have to start with Tatis. No question there.
And that's where it would end for, I think, every Padres fan.
Yeah, but I think it would start with Tatis because Yelich is more valuable than either Stanton or Ozuna is. And people say, well, no, Stanton's a better player. But it's like, you're not just trading a player, you're trading their contracts too. And if Stanton didn't have that contract, it obviously would affect so much more for him than they did because it comes with a $300 million commitment. Yelich, of course, has a terrific contract situation. And if the Padres want to say, hey, let's compete right now because we want to, Yelich at least is a really good player and a really good value who's likely to be around for a while. I don't know if it's his ideal park. I think he'd do really well at Petco. I think that a team that has more of a need for a center fielder would get more use out of him. But he's a terrific player. The question is the price. And unlike with Stanton, the Marlins do have some leverage with Yelich because everyone's going to want Yelich. So if you're not prepared to talk about one of your top prospects, it's going to be hard to get him from the Marlins.
I have a quick related question that popped in my head. Austin Hedges is beloved by Padres fans, both for being devilishly handsome and for, you know, making exciting defensive plays. I was reading what the Marlins could get for Real Muto, who's obviously a little more established and has had more success at the plate than someone like Hedges. But I think Padres fans assume Austin Hedges is just here to stay. Like, he's a core player until he's a free agent. Without knowing like how you've projected him next year, does someone like Austin Hedges have a lot of outsized trade value, like someone like Real Muto, or are people still kind of waiting to see if he's can hit at all? He did hit with some power last year, you know, but
and he's had his moments. I mean, he did hit like 600 in the Pacific Coast League the year before.
Right.
Of course, it's the Pacific Coast League, but still, he's an excellent defensive catcher, slugging 600 anywhere. I mean, that's at least something to be interested in.
And I hear outsized, very attractive value for someone like Real Muto. It makes me think, you know, maybe Hedges has more value on another team for a team like the Padres than he would for than he has, you know, keeping him for another 4 years, 3 years. They didn't mishandle his service time here, but
he's not a star now. I think people get a little excited about that, but I do think that he is young, he is cost controlled. I do think that he's not a foundational player. Zips actually gives him a 2-win projection in 2018. So it's not like the projections hate him or anything. He's a good enough defensive player that if he has his OPS somewhere like 675 to 700, he's a solid average player. Mm-hmm. And I think he can do that. He does have some pop. You just hope that it's not like with like a 260 on base percentage or something. But I do think that probably he has more value to the Padres than he would in a trade. I don't think other teams are going to be quite as in love with him.
Because we are very much in love with him.
Yeah. What is it with the Padres developing catchers named Austin? Because Austin Barnes, the departed one, has turned to be a pretty good utility guy, too.
Yeah. Austin Barnes, the Dodgers?
Yeah.
Catcher?
He had a 400 on base percentage in 2017.
Yeah. Yeah. Ugh. Instead, we get Hedges. Hedges, we get devilishly handsome, but poor on base percentage. That's
he's like the new Ben Davis, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Catchers are weird. They develop kind of strangely. There's so many catchers that just were really good as young players. They just burnt out quickly, as we were talking about. There's always a joke, you know, that Baseball Prospectus uses there's no such thing as a pitching prospect. I'm not sure there's such a thing as a catching prospect.
Yeah, so the Padres sort of have a cluster of second baseman and third baseman going into, well, January here. Obviously, there's Solarte and Headley, but there's also Villanueva, the former Cubs top prospect. Corey Spangenberg, one of our old first-round picks. Carlos Asuaje, who we got back in the Craig Kimbrel deal. Even Jose Perel has played some second base, although he's a left fielder now. Who does Zips like in that group the most, in terms of not just like overall wins above replacement, but of those players, and I guess you can kind of throw out Solarte and Headley because they're a little bit older. So if we just focused on Asuaje, Spangenberg, and Villanueva, which one of those do you think has the best chance of actually contributing to a Padres World Series team? And it's okay if you say none of them.
Well, Zips has been a big fan of Asuaje for quite a while. So that's probably the answer to that question. And I think he's at an age where you kind of need to learn pretty quickly what you have in him, which is why I do think if they're smart, and again, not sure if they are, I don't think Headley plays another game with the team. I think he's, in a way, he's kind of a MacGuffin like Matt Kemp was, kind of just thrown in to make the trade work, to make the trade plot work.
Yeah, I think Padres fans will collectively lose their minds if he plays. The same Joe Dickhead in Lakeside that's been giving you all the crap also thinks Chase Headley was the worst player that ever played for the Padres, even though he might have been one of the best in the past decade. Like 15th all-time on the team's WAR leadership board.
I didn't know there was any hate for him in San Diego. That's actually a new one on me.
That was a very divisive topic for you for a year.
Okay, I might have just forgotten because I'm getting old and slightly senile.
You may remember Chase Headley had a I think it was a 4 home run season. That was the demarcation point for a lot of fans and then that became an analytics versus counting stats argument where he was excellent defensively. Like he was still producing wins above replacement that year, but it was very, very divisive.
He was almost like the exact opposite of Hosmer. Like he did a lot of things that added value to his bottom line that you didn't see in the box score, right? Made a nice play at third that maybe 90% of third basemen don't make. And so it counts positively towards his defensive statistics. Whereas Hosmer, on the other hand, and he might draw maybe one walk and have a single. And so overall, it looks like a pretty decent game analytically, but in the box score, it just looks like a ho-hum 1-for-4 effort with a walk and maybe one play on defense. Whereas Hosmer, you watch him and he looks good. He hits doubles, hits home runs. He looks like he's good at first, but the numbers come back and say something a little bit different. So I think, yeah.
It's funny about Chase Headley. The offseason that him and Pablo Sandoval were both free agents, I took a lot of heat for saying, you know, I think Headley is, I'd rather have Headley for the same money as Sandoval. I'd take Headley if their contracts are identical. And I got some heat for that. And I was right, but kind of in the saddest possible way.
Yeah.
Because Headley was a lot better than Sandoval. And he was 5 wins in 3 years. So it's like, I was right in a depressing way.
Well, Headley last year had a higher on base percentage than any Padre. Unless you count Jose Perella's small sample season.
Yeah,
which is kind of amazing.
He did have his highlights in New York. I mean, his defense has dropped off considerably, which is probably another reason the Padres shouldn't be entering the season with him at third. And they talk about how they need Freddy Galvis to make the young pitching develop something. Then you probably don't want Headley at this point at third base.
Well, they are trying to reassemble the 2012 Padres with Tyson Ross and Chris Young also. So
and Clayton Richard and yeah.
Only a couple years trading for Matt Kemp again.
Yeah.
I got so many people So many people were mad at me. More people were mad at me that week than were mad at me last week.
That's related to my last question for you. Do you have, like, conferences with, like, Buster Olney and Keith Law where you guys discuss the vast national conspiracy to hate the Padres? Like, do you guys meet at like, a Holiday Inn in Columbus or anything like that?
Well, no. Keith just sends me the orders by courier.
Because that's what Padres fans think. They you probably saw it about how biased you are. Like, that's what's hilarious to me is that having lived elsewhere, like, the Padres are the smallest possible blip in the sports world outside of San Diego. Like, a huge percentage of baseball fans probably forget that the Padres exist at all. And Padres fans are so self-centered that they think that these national writers who are traveling around and covering all kinds of baseball are really focusing in on just smashing the Padres. Like that's your that has an objective that has real payoff for you guys.
Yeah, the Padres aren't really notable to hate. It's like, why would you hate the Padres? It's not exactly that exciting. Nobody really hates the Padres. It's an ongoing thing. I think like 30 years ago, I can't remember the whole piece right now because I'm tired and it's after midnight where I am. Bill James described the Padres as bad jazz, and that just bored him to tears. Because, I mean, the Padres have, what, 490 win seasons in nearly half a century?
Yeah, we have the lowest win percentage in baseball history for all active teams. We have sunk below the Devil Rays, or the Rays now, I guess.
The goal of the team should be to establish a consistent enough winner so that people will hate you. People hate the Cubs more than they... There are a lot of people who hate the Cubs more than they did a few years ago. There's actual Astros haters right now because you want to hate the teams that are at the top of the league because you want your team to be at the top of the league. But nobody hates the Padres because no one's scared of the Padres. Everyone just watches the Padres and think, no, they're going to win 78 games and then blow up the team again. I mean, that's how people look at the Padres. And looking at their history, it's hard to really dispute that. Before, you know, the whole John Moore's marriage thing, there was kind of that brief blip where they were interesting, but never really a top elite team. But that was really the most interesting, you know, bit of extended success they've had in essentially team history. And even that was
ironically a period hated by huge swaths of the fans also.
Yeah, but we'll see. I mean, maybe the Padres won't do this. Maybe it's just noise. The Braves made a lot of noise about, you know, kind of short-circuiting the rebuild halfway because they wanted to win in a new park, and they never actually did that. They just kind of told the fans they were going to do that just to kind of keep interest up. So maybe it's all just a smokescreen. They're not going to sign Hosmer, and they're going to rebuild some more. So maybe I'm...
Yeah, that's my biggest hope as well, is that I think the team has discovered that a valuable marketing tool is to insert themselves into every possible rumor and keep fans interested without actually doing anything. So that's my biggest hope, actually, is this is just bluster. So I'm glad you've thought of it as well.
So that could be the case, but I take things as they come. And as people have realized and informed me greatly that I am not a fan of a possible Hosmer signing.
So, Dan, my last question for you, because I know it is past midnight where you are and also where I am. Trevor Hoffman is likely to get inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame coming up here shortly. I don't want to jinx it, but a lot of the models are predicting over 90% chance he's going to make it based on the votes that he's picked up and the votes that are still out there. After Hoffman for the Padres, there is not an obvious player that has played Major League Baseball yet that's going to go into the Hall of Fame as a Padre. I'm wondering, in your projection system, when you're looking at prospects in the minor leagues, at what point do those projections become useful to major league level? I want to say Zips used to come out with a percent chance of making the Hall of Fame sort of thing back in maybe like 2011 when they're posted individually at Baseball Think Factory. At what point, because I'm sort of looking at our, I'm looking ahead, and I'm wondering exactly how good Fernando Tatis Jr. and Gore are going to be. And I'm wondering at what point can we trust the minor league projections or their stats in the minor leagues and the possible zip projections for them. Because honestly, our next chance of being a World Series caliber team is going to have both of those players being superstars, or at least one of them being very good if we want our window to open soon. So it's sort of a backwards way of getting to at what point can we actually trust the Zips projections for those two prospects?
Well, the projections, that they have larger error bars, but the midpoints aren't really any riskier. It's just kind of there's a wider range. I never did specific Hall of Fame projections of that type, but I used to do the whole career projection for there. I mean, I still do them usually in articles and stuff. And like when I do the Zips top 100 prospects every year, generally to establish like a Hall of Fame chance, you do have to have some major league time just to, sorry, I have a cat that's getting complaining. Projection systems aren't going to predict a lot of guys to have an average result of Hall of Fame. So you don't really see them until they have a lot of success in the majors. And obviously, we're not at that point yet. So we're probably a little too soon to talk about, you know, Hall of Fame for some of them. But it could happen.
Tell that to Padres fans.
Yeah, you don't want to...
But that is sort of what we need to be rooting for, right? I mean, it's really hard to envision a scenario where the Padres get good in 2021 and 2022 and are actually trying to win a World Series without 5+ win above replacement players who can become those, you know, guys that have a Adrian Beltre early career Dodgers 9 win above replacement season. You know, like we have to get one of those guys in order to really compete at the national level.
Osber. Yeah. Someone was saying that they're gonna laugh when like Hosmer has 20 WAR and gets votes for the Hall of Fame in 15 years. Probably the player that Zips likes the most is Margot. It has him as a 30 to 40 win player depending on assumptions, which is a really good player. Zips has been a fan of him really when he was pretty low in the minors when he was still with the Red Sox. Zips was a pretty big fan of him. So he's probably their best chance to kind of explode. It won't be like the typical star season. You might have, you know, more like a Kevin Kiermaier type season where he saves 20 wins and is a league average offensive player, which makes him a star. But I think he's probably one of their best chances that's in the majors now. But again, that's what we talk about, the filtering out process. You want to see those guys. You want to get as many of those guys that could possibly be that good. So I think we've kind of gone like full circle.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. I wanted to say thanks for coming on the podcast. I know it's late there, but this has been really great. I've learned a lot on this podcast today.
Well, thanks for having me, guys. It's a break from slowly freezing to death.
Yeah, and I thought it would be a good opportunity to have you come talk to all the haters, because they will listen to the podcast. They will have they will get to listen to you reason out why you don't like a potential Hosmer signing. And I think it's healthy for them to hear someone play devil advocate and still not necessarily make too great of points. Because I think it is important that all the fans realize that signing Hosmer, it could work. Like you said, there's
I could be wrong.
A 20% chance that it... Yeah, 20% chance that he does it, but you should be rooting for the 80% chance, right? You'd much rather be on the side where the gambling is more of a certain bet than on the other side. But
you don't get rich in Vegas making bets on 20%, right?
No.
Well, unless the
odds are such. Yeah.
If you're paid like there's a 5% chance.
Yeah.
Sorry, I love prop bets. So I do like to do that.
All right, well, thank you again for joining, and until next time, go Padres fans.
Go Padres.